Welcome to the Off the Charts Football Podcast. I am your host for this week, Corey March. I'm the head of business development and sports info solutions, resident fantasy expert, and a self-proclaimed fantasy expert. I'm not your normal host. Matt Manicharian is off for this week, enjoying some well-deserved time off. But I am joined by Matt's normal co-host, Aaron Schatz, the godfather of football analytics and founder of Football Outsiders, and our special guest this week, honored to bring back Scott Spratt, who's the senior analyst and fantasy football expert of Football Outsiders. Obviously, our producer, Justin Stein, the versatile Justin Stein, on the controls. Good to be here with everybody. Good to have Scott on the podcast. I wonder what percentage of our audience is aware that the OGs of this podcast were Scott and Aaron back in the day before Matt took over. Scott and Aaron used to be the ones and twos. So welcome back, Scott.
Yeah, thanks, Corey. Glad to join the show. Yeah, I guess it's true that I'm a bit of a traitor, former SIS employee, now with Football Outsiders, but I think we're still kind of a big, happy family. And I know Aaron and I, we both are ready for some vacation if that's what Matt's doing, because we've had a trying time the last few weeks.
Yeah, I know. Getting the almanac out is a push in the last few weeks, but I can't even remember now. I'm trying to remember. I wanted to say, oh yeah, X number of years ago when we started the podcast. I honestly don't remember how many years we've been doing this podcast. I think it's 5, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think 2016 is probably the last season on the air for me, is my recollection.
The good old days back before the world was so much more complicated. How was the almanac process this year? Congrats on the release.
Got things done a little earlier than in the last couple of years, and that's a good thing. We got to do some extra proofreading, so I think there's fewer errors in it than usual. That's a good thing. But the problem is, of course, that hanging in the back of our heads the whole time is, you know, how much of what we're previewing is really going to happen. I mean, between the time I finished editing the college section and when the almanac came out, in between those two dates is when the Pac-12 and the Big Ten announced they were going to an all-conference schedule. So, like, already the book is a little out of date. Things are going to move so fast over the next few weeks with whatever's going to happen with college football, but also with the NFL. And, you know, we had to preview the season basically as if the season's going to happen the way we normally expect the season to happen. You know, you can't write COVID-19 into a statistical projection system because there are no past COVID-19s to use as examples of what might happen. It was a weird year to do the book. There's no question about it.
Yeah. In the current climate, you just have to do the best you can with the circumstances as they currently exist. Things are changing day to day. You just have to go about your business.
See, the good news for me, Corey, is that since this was my first year with the Almanac, I've just been paranoid that I'm going to make some kind of really stupid kind of prediction. But the silver lining of maybe not having an NFL season is nobody can hold me accountable in any way there.
It's the silver lining all around, because let's be honest, if there is an NFL season, I would expect it to be even weirder and less predictable than usual. And I think we can write off all of our wrong predictions as, well, COVID.
Absolutely. Great call, Aaron.
Yeah, there are no stupid predictions this year. And on that note, we'll transition into our topics for the day. So you all may be familiar with me. I tend to come on the podcast from time to time to talk about fantasy. And now the time of year, entering into fantasy football draft season, we figured it would be an appropriate topic to cover. So today we're going to prepare for the fantasy football season in terms of what to expect from an unconventional 2020 season. We're going to use the new Kubiak system to break down players that we feel are misrepresented by ADP or average draft position. So Scott's going to tell us a little bit more about the new Kubiak system. But we'll start by taking a step back and trying to wrap our heads around what all this means and how things are going to play out on Sundays with all of the abnormalities in our lives. And the first thing I want to bring up are the fact that certain players and certain teams aren't going to have the usual amount of preparation and preseason games to get up to speed and get acquainted with their teams and their new systems. And I think my most firm stance to this end is on rookies. the fact that it's hard enough to transition from college to pro, but now throw in the fact that there's very limited preseason, very limited OTAs, and just working together in general. It seems like there are a handful of exciting players who are entering the league and still coming off draft boards, at least right now, pretty high as they normally would. Guys like Clyde Edwards-Helaire, Jonathan Taylor, J.K. Dobbins, all of who have capable alternatives in their backfields. I wonder how much teams will lean on these veterans who are well-established, trusted in terms of blitz pickup and just what they're going to give you on a day-to-day basis. What do you guys think about this?
Well, I don't want to make light of the complexities of entering the NFL, but I do feel like for running backs in particular, it's a little bit easier of a transition than for other positions, in particular tight ends and quarterback, for guys that might be fantasy relevant. So I have a little bit more faith that the major running backs, you know, the Clyde Edwards-Helaires of the world, can transition and be productive as rookies. The real issue might be from a blocking perspective. That's something that I think Edwards-Helaire in particular has had some scouts have suggested that may not be his best attribute necessarily, but he can catch passes and he can find holes pretty effectively, I think. So I wouldn't be too worried about it from a running back perspective.
I'd say dial down your wide receivers. I'd say dial down your quarterbacks who are not definitely starting week one, which means anybody other than Joe Burrow. And I would, of course, not even touch any of the rookie tight ends.
Yeah, not necessarily a strong rookie tight end class.
It's not a strong class at a position that generally doesn't do well for rookies in a year that doesn't look like it's going to be good for rookies. Don't go anywhere near any of them.
One guy in particular, Jonathan Taylor, I was very excited about coming into the league. He looked unstoppable on the ground in college. Seemed like one of, or his biggest flaw is in the passing game, and now enter Philip Rivers, who threw to running backs on a league-high 29% of his pass attempts last year. I wonder how much they'll ease him in. Philip is not a very mobile quarterback, although he'll be behind a better offensive line this year, so maybe a little bit of that is less of an emphasis. But you have Marlon Mack, you have Nyheim Hines. I wonder how much you trust those guys over throwing Taylor in, who could be a game-breaker, but it's a little bit of an unknown.
I will say in the backcast projections, Taylor has the best backcast ever, which is our running back projection system as far as running. But he does have a negative receiver index, which means that he's not expected to be a great receiver. So what you say basically definitely applies. He's someone you're really excited about as a ground on the ground game. But, you know, he's not a receiver, and that means he may not get as much play.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, I think Taylor is someone I would have probably had. I mean, depending on whether Edwards-Helaire ended up in Kansas City or not, or that type of thing, probably would have been first or second for me from a fantasy perspective this year. But I have him behind DeAndre Swift, for instance, just because of the relative, you know, situations they landed in, that I think is probably going to keep Taylor's workload, and in particular, the fantasy relevant workload, like receptions in PPR formats, a little bit lower.
And then you talk about a couple of the high end receivers, CeeDee Lamb, Jerry Jeudy, going into pretty crowded and talented receiving corps, so their impact out of the gate might be more subtle than normal, but still excited about those guys, although probably won't be going too close to them in fantasy this year.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to take a shot on a rookie fantasy receiver, it might behoove you to wait for a later option, maybe a Brandon Ayuk or a Denzel Mims or somebody that has a little bit more of a chance to see a big workload based on the other offensive players around them. That maybe won't be, you know, stretching the budget of your fantasy draft when there's so many of these guys who have uncertain roles, especially this year.
I'm going to bring up the name Antonio Gandy-Golden is exciting. I remember his tape on draft day, crushing a Rubik's Cube and then doing a backflip and all these ridiculous acrobatic athletic maneuvers. And he's 6'5", and now maybe on the field all the time or the majority of the time. Could be an exciting guy to look out for late in drafts.
When the news broke about Harmon, I did bump him from a workload perspective more than any other Redskins player. But I will also say that Steven Sims is really one of my favorite sleepers this year. He was more of a returner last year, an undrafted guy, but a lot of quickness and speed. It's ridiculous to say that he looks like Tyreek Hill, but he looks like Tyreek Hill to me. I could really see him exploding on offense this season too.
Yeah, Steven Sims. I remember not really knowing much about him, but then they would get the ball in his hands and most other guys would just, you know, it would be a moderate gain and he would just take off and it would be like, whoa, who is this guy? And it happened a few times.
It did. He had a really low average depth of target last year, which, I mean, I kind of get the get him in space type of attitude, but I'd love to see him get some shots down the field too. And that, I think that would maybe increase his fantasy value if he was getting a little bit more depth on his targets.
In terms of roster construction, is there anything to consider this year differently than you would in a normal year? For me personally, I'm looking to handcuff running backs more than I normally would. Based on some of the reports I'm hearing, it seems like players could be declared inactive unexpectedly, just based on the fact that they'll be showing up and have their temperature taken and could be ruled out when they've been otherwise healthy and practicing. So I think it avoids a little bit of the complexity to just have that player's direct backup on your bench and not have to go searching on the waiver wire for guys who would not otherwise be playing.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there, Corey. And beyond sort of the obvious names, I mean, you have Kareem Hunt behind Nick Chubb, Tony Pollard behind Ezekiel Elliott, Latavius Murray behind Alvin Kamara, and Alexander Mattison behind Dalvin Cook, who may also be holding out. So those are probably your big four names there. But also take a look at Damian Harris behind Sony Michel. Justin Jackson, maybe not specifically being behind Austin Eckler, but somebody who would be a lot more valuable if Eckler were out. And then two rookies, Darrington Evans and LaMichael Perrin, who are a little bit lower draft guys, maybe not on the top of everybody's draft list as rookies, but behind Derrick Henry and Le'Veon Bell, could see a lot of work there. And even, I don't know how you feel about this, Aaron, but like some wide receivers actually have guys you could consider handcuffing. You have Mecole Hardman behind Tyreek Hill, I think would be probably a plug-and-play top 10 receiver if Hill missed time. Maybe Kenny Stills behind either Will Fuller or Brandon Cooks. Maybe Preston Williams behind Devontae Parker. And choose your wide receiver behind Debo Samuel, who's going to start the year injured for the 49ers. Like, any thoughts there, maybe?
I guess that would be Ayuk right now. One of the problems is without having OTAs, it's hard to know what some of these Jets charts are right now. I think the issue of handcuffs is tied in with the issue of how you're going to have to change your league's rules to deal with COVID, because I think that it's a really good idea for leagues to have more bench positions than usual this year, because you're going to have more game time decisions and you're not going to want to have to drop your top players just because they get ruled out an hour ahead of time on a Sunday and you have to go pick up somebody when you're in the middle of bye weeks and you have nobody on your bench. So I think if you're a fantasy league, there's two things you've got to think about for this year. One is you've got to have more bench positions. And two is you've got to have some sort of rules set up for what happens if the season is suspended or finished in the middle.
Definitely true. But I want to piggyback on one point there you made, Aaron, which is that I think in-season management is going to be very important this season, more so than in a normal year. And it's something that I think a lot of people, maybe more casual players, like to draft a team and stick with that team. But there are really a lot of opportunities, even in season-long fantasy, to play matchups. And there are going to be more players this year that, even if they're not draft day considerations, become relevant matchup plays. That happens at positions that people don't even consider, like quarterback. I mean, players like Drew Brees, you shouldn't be starting them every week. I mean, he's really a guy that performs much better in fantasy at home. And you're going to be able to find guys with favorable defensive opponents and favorable venues to start from week to week. And if you're dealing with players that are unexpectedly out, you can grab those guys and kind of not miss a beat.
Yeah, you really want to be cognizant about your bench for playing matchups and for the fact that guys may just not play, surprisingly, and you're just going to have to find a backup, and you don't want to be stuck that week with no backup receivers that are playing.
Maybe instead of deeper benches and really thin waiver wire in case guys go out, no benches at all. Imagine Saquon Barkley gets sidelined for 2 weeks and you need to decide whether to drop him or take his in your lineup for a couple weeks. Now there is a twist.
Yeah, it's occurred to me that it may be a better move to, instead of going with a stars and scrubs approach to your draft, which is one that typically works really well in fantasy football, to maybe go with more mid-priced type of guys. That this makes more sense in an auction than it would in a snake draft. But if you have more mid-priced guys, that spreads out the risk of missing a few games over more relevant players on your roster. And also probably makes it easier for you to cut players if somebody gets sick and misses a few weeks, whereas you probably won't want to do that if you end up, you know, with a top fantasy player on your team that misses time.
Sports Info Solutions is excited to announce its Football Analytics Challenge. Contestants will use Sports Info Solutions data to determine which defensive line position is the most valuable and how does the value change based on factors like in-game situation. Registration is now open and submissions are due for preliminary judging by Sunday, July 19th. Three finalists will be chosen to present their work live to a panel of judges, including Matt Manacharian, Aaron Schatz, and John Park from the Indianapolis Colts front office. In addition to some great exposure within the industry, winner will receive a free one-year subscription to the SIS Data Hub Pro and will be invited to appear on this podcast to discuss their research with Matt and Aaron. And the best part, all proceeds from the event will go to the United Negro College Fund. A minimum $1 donation is required for entry, but we encourage any of our listeners to donate to this worthy cause. For more information and to register today, check out the pinned tweet on the Sports Info Solutions Twitter account. That's @sportsinfo_SIS. All right, let's transition into more of a position-by-position breakdown here. We're going to look at each position, specifically how players are looking through the new Kubiak system and how that relates to their current ADP. So I want to start by throwing to Scott for a brief explanation of Kubiak and its unique components, because I know I could use some more info, and I'm sure our listeners, before we get into these players, would like to know a little bit more about how the system works.
So we overhauled Kubiak this offseason, so there's a lot to get into here that may be better served for people to check out in the Almanac and in other forums, but I'll try to touch on things as briefly as I can. In essence, the system splits into projecting player touches and then projecting players' efficiencies per touch. The former group, I think, is probably more of your standard type of thing where you're looking at team pass and run plays based on, you know, recent quarterback and head coach historical tendencies. But there's some cool things there too. It looks at, you know, a team's overall DVOA projection versus their opponents. And when that's higher, it leads to more rushing attempts. Basically, you're thinking about game script here, where when teams go up by multiple scores in games, they tend to run the ball more in the second half. That's something that the fantasy projections reflect as well. But the efficiency projections, I think, are where some of the really cool things happen. We split it up so that a quarterback projects his accuracy to specific player roles, and then the players themselves have their efficiencies take over there once they receive a catchable target. So that's a sort of split that happens that helps it so that if a quarterback switches teams or a wide receiver switches teams or has a new quarterback come in, it sort of handles out that transition in a way that can be difficult when you look at them in isolation. There's obviously a lot of regression that's happening, but from a specific standpoint, scoring is regressed based on opportunity-adjusted touchdowns, which I think tends to be a better way to do it than looking at just touchdowns in general. And then each week, the efficiencies are adjusted based on the context of games. So you're talking about venue-related issues, whether it's at home or on the road, in a dome or outdoors, you know, weather forecast issues, and opponent tendencies. That's something that we do with our weekly projection system as well, and it probably makes more sense to focus on that from a weekly perspective. But even over the course of a full season, those elements can make a big difference for you in fantasy.
Sounds really thorough and well thought out. I appreciate that. I sometimes wonder with all these projection systems out there how elaborate they are and how much they actually take into account.
I mean, I won't guarantee that our projection system is the best, but I'll guarantee that I spend a lot of time working on it.
Yeah, the other big difference I will say for people who are used to the original Kubiak system, is that the original Kubiak system sort of projected everybody to play the whole season. And so you would end up with sort of more receiving and rushing projected than a team would actually end up with because of the idea that some of these players would have injuries. So now the injuries are kind of baked into the projections. So the likelihood of injuries is baked in. So the season-long projections that are in Football Outsiders Almanac will look like everybody is dropping in workload. But what that is that it's basically pricing in the possibility of injury. So when you look at the projections against each other, when you look at rankings, it's still the same as it was before. It's not like anybody is particularly lower. But if you look at, like, compared to what a guy did last year, you have to realize that it's pricing in the possibility of injury. But what happens that way is that when you project the whole team, it adds up to what we actually think the team will do, not like 15% more than what we think the team will do.
And I think gives a more realistic representation of what's likely to happen for you in fantasy. Specifically for this season, I think quarterbacks tended to land in that like 13.5 to 14.5.
It was like 14.5 to 15 games per quarterback.
That's the one. Thanks, Aaron. We're guys that are likely to suffer more hits. Think running quarterbacks or maybe players that take more sacks. They have a higher risk of being injured, and quarterbacks that are older, like older than 36 maybe in particular, start seeing an increase in those injuries as well.
Is that where the color-coded risk factor system comes into play?
So that's actually happening for every player together. And then the color-coded risk adjustments are sort of on top of that and make a more radical, I would say, adjustment to fantasy projections. So that's a situation where you're looking at somebody like, say, a Darius Geis, a guy that's had a lot of knee issues both in college and in the pros, that we think is probably somebody you should discount because of a greater chance of being hurt. Although some of those risk factors, I'll point out, aren't specifically related to injuries. They can be other risk factors as well.
Right. The example of that is there's a blue risk for players that we think are particularly strong breakout candidates, like Denzel Mims is an example, because the players who are ahead of him on the depth chart for the Jets are so questionable. You know, he's got a little bit more upside. Mecole Hardman is another one like that. Some backup running backs come out that way.
All right, now with all that great context, let's dive into the quarterback position first. We'll start with Dak Prescott. In the Kubiak system, he rates third, and ESPN has him sixth. Scott, you want to tell us a little bit more about Dak?
Yeah, we have a couple things kind of going into that discrepancy. I think the first is there's a bit of a misconception about the type of player that Prescott is. Obviously, he's super famous being the Cowboys quarterback, but I think he's probably a better player than most people give him credit for. To point, he had a 27.1% passing DVOA last season. That was the sixth of 34 quarterbacks with 200 attempts. And in the upper tier of guys, really, it was ahead of Russell Wilson, ahead of Deshaun Watson, Aaron Rodgers, Matt Ryan. I mean, he really is very effective from that perspective. Although I'll point out the DVOA is sort of a team-based metric, so it includes how good the player's surrounding cast is. And it really doesn't get any better situationally than Prescott has it in Dallas. Obviously, you have the fact that he plays in the dome. That's something that we expect will boost his fantasy production by about 13 fantasy points over what a true talent context-neutral situation would be. He has a tremendous offensive line. They were second last year in adjusted sack rate. And then adding CeeDee Lamb in the draft, one of the most talented players, I think a very high playmaking scorer, just makes
a playmaker score. He was number one, I believe, in playmaker score ahead of Judy.
So there you go. I mean, like, great talent there, adding to an already talent-rich receiving core. They were the third highest receiving core in receiving yards per catchable target last season. So not even counting the fact that some quarterbacks throw more accurate passes than others. This is a team that produced a lot when they caught the ball. And I think it's a very attractive situation for them again this season. And then finally, it's just a positive circumstance in terms of schedule. We're projecting him to gain 4.9 passing fantasy points because of his defensive opponents. That's the second most of the position. Beyond his own division, he faces the NFC West and AFC North this season. And so overall, that puts the Falcons, the Giants twice, the Cardinals, the Redskins twice, and the Bengals on the schedule, all of whom are in the top 10 of passing touchdowns per attempt increasers in football.
No question Dak has an elite supporting cast. The coaching change will impact Dak positively, negatively, no impact.
Oh, McCarthy likes to pass. McCarthy was always very, very high in pass-run ratio when he was with Green Bay. I think he likes to pass. I can't imagine that it's going to be negative for Prescott.
Plus, the fact that you have the continuity there at offensive coordinator and Kellen Moore, I think probably makes it a little bit more seamless. You get a little bit more of what you saw last year.
Sounds good to me. Fire up Dak. Although I'm more of a late-round quarterback guy. If Dak falls far enough, somebody to keep an eye on. For sure.
Yeah, if you want to go like really late quarterback here, I think Teddy Bridgewater may be a guy to look at. ESPN has him, I think, 25th this season, but we have him up at 13th. This is not related to my Panthers fandom, I assure you. There is a little bit of guesswork here. I mean, you have a totally new coaching staff here in Carolina with offensive coordinator Joe Brady. But I think we're guessing that Brady is going to lead to a lot more passing here in Carolina. He orchestrated Joe Burrow's amazing Heisman-winning campaign last year for LSU when he had 527 pass attempts, the second most in FBS. And so overall, we think the Panthers are going to be a pass-heavy team that probably ends up being even more pass-heavy given the fact that they are a projected bad team and will probably have to pass later in games for game script reasons.
Projected with the worst defense in the league, yep.
Yep, totally. The Panthers obviously have holes, in particular on the offensive line, but Bridgewater is a notorious checkdown guy, very low average depth of target. I think maybe helps him avoid some of the sacks that the Panthers' other quarterbacks took last year. They actually were tied for the most in football with 58. So not good, but I think Bridgewater will fare better from that perspective. And that he has an even better passing schedule of opponents than Prescott does. They have the NFC North and AFC West in their draw, which overall leads to the Raiders, Cardinals, Falcons twice, Lions, and Redskins on the schedule. And even some of the, I would say, scary defenses like the Saints and Buccaneers, both in the top 10 in projected overall DVOA defense. I think they're a little bit better matchups from a fantasy perspective, in particular because, again, if the Panthers fall behind, that's going to probably create fantasy points for Bridgewater as he passes late in games, even though the Panthers will probably be getting, you know, beaten but pretty badly.
Seems like the type of quarterback who would really enjoy playing with Christian McCaffrey.
I think McCaffrey and DJ Moore, I think, are particularly really good fits. Not so sure about the Robbie Anderson edition.
It's good to have a guy to take the top off, but yeah, I don't really love Robbie from a fantasy perspective.
You have to throw it down there for the top to get taken off, so I think that's the major concern.
Now let's take a look at a quarterback that Kubiak likes less than an EP, Ryan Tannehill. Scott, what's going on with Tannehill here?
Yeah, we have Tannehill down at 23rd at the position. I think that pretty much everyone expects some regression to happen here. Tannehill was incredibly successful from a fantasy perspective last year. Since taking over as a starter in week 7, he was third at the position with 22.5 fantasy points per game. But we may be projecting a little bit more personal regression for him and then some for his teammates as well. I would say check out in the Football Outsiders Almanac that just came out. Rivers McCown has a really good hit on this in the Titans chapter, talking about the players that had unprecedented jumps in their passing DVOA. And he kind of comps like guys like Ryan Fitzpatrick from 2018, Case Keenum from 2017, Andy Dalton from 2015, and Joe Flacco from 2014, who overall, these comps had their DVOAs drop pretty significantly. This is something that happens in general, and I think it happens a little bit more for a play-action-happy type of offense like Tannehill had. He had a lot of success on some of those deeper throws that maybe will suffer some regression next year. And then I'll point out, too, that you know, A.J. Brown, who I think everybody loves and is one of the hot sophomore wide receivers for fantasy this season, probably was pretty darn lucky. He averaged 4.4 more yards after the catch per catch last season based on our yards after the catch plus metric. And as Brian Knowles pointed out in an article about this online on footballoutsiders.com, only two other wide receivers have even exceeded 3, and he was again at 4.4. So this is a situation where there's a lot of things pointing to me that Tannehill is going to have less success in fantasy going forward.
I agree with the Tannehill regression. One thing that stood out to me, I saw he had 1.2 more yards per attempt under pressure than any other quarterback dating back to 2016. You know, an 11% touchdown rate under pressure and a 27% sack rate under pressure. So 38% of his pressured plays ended in either a touchdown or a sack. Seems like if he's getting sacked that often, he's not necessarily...
He takes a lot of sacks.
Yeah. So it seems like that touchdown number is going to come back to earth and probably the yards per attempt to some extent too. With A.J. Brown, I see him as such an exciting player. I totally get where you're coming from. If Tannehill comes back to earth, the cast is going to come back down to earth too. I know Tannehill just seemed to love to get him the ball and he was so good in space. SIS has a new on-off report, which is incredible. And he seemed very efficient with Mariota and Tannehill, but Tannehill seemed to get him the ball a lot more. His target share jumped from 14% to 23% with Tannehill. So I'm a little bit less down on A.J. Brown, but it's kind of a...
I don't think the doubt is about A.J. Brown getting lots of targets. I think the doubt is about A.J. Brown getting 20 yards of reception.
Very fair. He does seem to me like he's emerging as one of those bona fide number one, potentially dominant players in a similar vein to me as Courtland Sutton. I look at those two guys very, very similarly. Who would you guys rather have in fantasy this year, Brown or Sutton?
And I have to actually check the rankings there. But I just wanted to point out that like that efficiency was so important for the Titans last year because they had the fourth highest run ratio. So again, this is a team that kind of relies heavily on Derrick Henry, which makes it difficult for all of those players to get enough work to produce in fantasy.
Henry with the newly minted contract, I know.
Hey, Tannehill too.
Yeah, Tennessee ended up paying everybody. They didn't know would they be able to pay Tannehill or Henry, and the answer was both because the Henry contract is not as insane as you might think. It's like fifth in value for running backs per year, not first.
So we have A.J. Brown, a two-hole fantasy point advantage here over Cortland Sutton. They're the 22nd and 23rd wide receivers in PPR in our projections this season. So probably both a little bit lower than what I would expect the consensus would be.
You don't know what you're going to get with Drew Lock either, although I might like him a little bit more than most.
That's another team. I mean, we'll get into some of these teams later, but the Broncos have a shocking amount of skill position talent. It may be difficult for Sutton to have just like an overwhelming target share the way he did in previous year, at least last year.
Yeah, I think a lot depends there on the whole issue we were talking about earlier with rookies, because two of their top three receivers are going to be rookies in Judy and Hamler.
Yeah, so that could play out well for Sutton. He seems to me like the kind of guy who would be dominant if he got a high.
Could play out better earlier in the year than late in the year.
Let's move on to the running back position. We'll start with a couple of guys that Kubiak likes more than their ADP, and we'll start with Joe Mixon.
So I got two major points here with Mixon. The first is I think he suffered from really bad touchdown luck last season. He just had 5 rushing touchdowns, and based on his opportunity-adjusted rushing touchdowns, he should have had 9.3. So for any fantasy player that doesn't know what opportunity-adjusted rushing touchdowns or touchdowns are in general, it's a concept that Mike Clay, who writes for ESPN, came up with back in his Pro Football Focus days. And essentially, it suggests that running backs in particular, where they touch the ball on the field is a lot more predictive of whether they'll score touchdowns in the future than how many touchdowns they actually scored with those opportunities. So this is a situation where Mixon was getting a lot of like looks near the goal line that he didn't necessarily punch in. And while we sort of think of that as a skill-related issue with players like Derrick Henry having success, by and large, players that get those opportunities score at similar rates, and those rates regress from year to year. So I think it's a situation where Mixon is probably going to score several more times. We have him projected for 7.9 touchdowns on the ground this season, so almost 3 more. And then the other point, and this kind of maybe feeds into that issue a little bit too, is that the Bengals had pretty stark splits from the first half to the second half of the season last year that followed a scheme change that new head coach Zach Taylor and his offensive line coach Jim Turner put in place, shifting from a zone blocking running scheme to a pin and pull scheme. And after which, Mixon just had a lot more success. He went from 12.6 carries per game, 3.2 yards per carry, and a negative 22% DVOA in the first half to 22.1 carries per game, 4.6 yards per carry, and 11.2% DVOA in the second half. I think that's something that can persist going forward, maybe even do better with a potentially better quarterback in Joe Burrow at center helping them out. So I think it's a very good situation for Mixon going into next season.
Yeah, I have faith in Zach Taylor to figure things out as he gains more experience, and Mixon finally playing in an offense you can get excited about. The next player we'll talk about is James Conner. Dealt with some injuries last year, dealt with some definite inconsistencies at the quarterback position with Ben out of the lineup. So Scott, tell us a little bit about Conner.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. I think injuries are pretty much the major reason why we are going to be different than other rankers. I know from our perspective, even including the downgrade that you get from the red risk factor, we have Connor projected for 231 carries that probably become in the ballpark of 208 when you make that adjustment, whereas ESPN, for instance, projects him for 170. So this is probably really an issue that you're considering with his injury history. And he's had a lot of injuries in his career, no doubt. I mean, he tore his MCL in college. He suffered from Hodgkin's lymphoma in college, quite famously. He missed time with a leg injury in 2018 and missed 6 weeks with knee and shoulder injuries last year. So when you sort of say them all out loud, it sounds like an overwhelming issue. But I'll point out that he still has had at least 215 carries in 3 of his last 6 seasons, some of those being in college. But one of those also, he was a backup for Le'Veon Bell, so we didn't expect him to carry the ball very much at all. So 3 of his last 5 playing seasons, he's reached that 215 threshold. it's really an issue about how comfortable you feel with that type of projection. We kind of apply more even types of injury assumptions to running backs. It's just a position that the players tend to get hurt. Not necessarily saying that he is radically more injury prone than anybody else. I mean, he's in the red class with the guys like Darius Geis and all, but it's a situation where I think there's a lot of optimism that he can play and would be probably a workhorse back if he did play, at least based on Mike Tomlin's history of using primary bell cow backs and things that Tomlin has said about him in this offseason.
Right. He was in and out of the lineup a lot last year, but I don't know how much he was actually even healthy when he was in the lineup.
This is definitely one where it shows how fantasy projections are an art as much as a science, because there's a lot here that comes into trying to read Mike Tomlin's mind based on his previous decisions.
Definitely true, Aaron.
Steelers were second last in expected points earned on running plays by running backs last year.
That whole offense was a freaking disaster area last year, and I think everybody assumes that as long as Roethlisberger's healthy, it's going to be a much different situation this season.
Okay, one back that Kubiak is not as excited about is Nick Chubb.
Yeah, it's hard to even admit that we're not as excited, because Chubb really is one of the most exciting players in football. But I think it's unavoidable that Chubb was a lot less productive from a fantasy perspective after Kareem Hunt returned from the first half of the year that he missed with the suspension. So Chubb specifically fell from 19.3 attempts and 4 targets per game in the first half to 18 attempts and 2.3 targets per game in the second half. So, you know, losing about 4 touches per game once Hunt returned. And it's easy to forget, and maybe it's easy to sort of write off because of how good the Chiefs teams were that Hunt was a part of, but Hunt is a really, really good running back. He has 7.9% rushing and 14.2% receiving DVOA or better in all 3 of his NFL seasons. And so that includes now 2 teams, making it more and more likely that that's just his natural talent level. So I think it's a situation where everyone wants to be excited about all of the exciting skill position players on the Browns, but like the ADP suggests that Chubb is a top 10 running back, that Kareem Hunt is a top 25 running back, Odell Beckham is a top 15 wide receiver, Jarvis Landry is a top 25 receiver, and Austin Hooper is a top 15 tight end in fantasy. I just don't think that can happen for all of those players at the same time. I don't mean to signal out Chubb as being a guy that maybe in particular has more risk than those other players, but I think if you try to add up everything for all the players, it's just a situation where there's not enough touches to go around for everybody to be as successful as we want them to be.
I feel like people have been very optimistic on the Browns coming to the past few seasons, and it's just gotten to the point where they have to prove it.
That's basically the whole point of the chapter in the Football Outsiders Almanac, is that, you know, you can tell a really good narrative about why the Browns will be good this year, but the numbers won't believe it until it happens.
Exactly.
Even if they are really good, that doesn't mean they're going to have, like, you know, 700 pass attempts.
Right. There's still a limit to how many how many touches there are to go around on this offense.
One of my favorite stats looks at how much Nick Chubb has outproduced the field in terms of yards after contact since becoming the starter in Cleveland. More than 100 yards more than number 2, Derrick Henry. Kind of related to that, Bryce Rossler wrote an article on the Sports Info Solutions blog yesterday that uses analytics to break down the new Madden ratings, which I thought was an interesting angle.
Nice.
And Chubb had the highest broken tackle rating by 3. I think it was a 97, 3 over Josh Jacobs.
None of this is to diss on Nick Chubb. Basically, our opinion about Nick Chubb can be summarized as Kareem Hunt matters.
Yeah, I bet Kareem Hunt has a pretty high Madden rating too, right?
If he doesn't, he should. In terms of those broken tackle ratings, I think about this sometimes, and personally, more than anybody, I would hate to tackle Derrick Henry. So I think he should be number 1. But I can't argue with Chubb being number 1. Moving on from running backs, let's get into a few receivers who popped up here with some discrepancies. First one we'll look at is Julio Jones, who Kubiak has his number 1.
Michael Thomas is probably the big name that stands out as being a strange fit as number behind Julio Jones. Not like we have a big difference there either, but I think some people will probably have
Michael Thomas 2, so it's not like we have him like 12.
Yeah, but I mean, there are a handful of those top-tier guys like your Davante Adamses of the world that they could be in this conversation, and I think most people would probably put Jones at the bottom of that tier. ESPN has him 4th. We like Jones, 1, because it's a very stable situation, a very stable player. He's played 14 to 16 games for 6 straight seasons, caught 83 or more passes, for 1,394 plus yards for six straight seasons. He actually just missed on reaching 1,400 in six straight with the final game last year. But I think the reason that Jones tends to fall behind those other guys is a reputation that he developed for being a bad touchdown scorer that I think came mostly from a three touchdown season in 2017 during the Falcons Super Bowl hangover situation. In that year, Jones caught just two of 19 end zone targets, obviously a shockingly low total for a guy that looks like he should catch a lot. But to that point, he's rebounded for nine end zone catches on 20 end zone targets the last 2 years. So I think it's a situation where whether it was, you know, Steve Sarkisian's fault or whatever it was that created a really weird year for Jones in 2017, that isn't who he is as a player. I have very little concerns about his ability to score touchdowns next year and going forward. So I think he's just as safe and as productive as it gets at the position.
Yeah, the Falcons had an unreasonably low touchdown rate in the red zone last year. Seems like a stat that usually has regression towards the mean. I'm buying into the Julio scores more touchdowns this year. I've also seen a lot of Calvin Ridley hype.
Ridley was another player that graded out a little better for us than the ADP as well. It's just, we really like that offense, the stability, the fact that they're in a dome. It's just, it's a really great situation for fantasy.
Yeah, the Falcons started to come around late in the year last year when people started to get healthy. Taking a look at their win total projection for this year, 7.5 seems about right. I wanted to go over on them, but that number, I don't know. I don't feel too confident about going over, although I would lean over if I had to choose a side.
Corey, read the Falcons write-up that I did in the Almanac, and there's some good perspective there on whether or not you should be optimistic about their team.
Excellent. I will absolutely do that. Let's talk about Juju Smith-Schuster.
Smith-Schuster is an interesting one. Like, obviously, he'll probably do much better in fantasy if Roethlisberger is able to play a full healthy season. But I still am a little bit pessimistic from his fantasy perspective because of sort of the way that he burst onto the scene in fantasy in the first place. And in his rookie season, he had just an incredible split on his DVOA from the slot and out wide, 59.3% DVOA from the slot, 6.5% DVOA out wide. And in the 2 years since, he's been pretty much neutral overall in DVOA out wide. It's a situation where I think Smith-Schuster is probably going to spend more and more time out wide going forward in his career. He's 6'1" and 215 pounds, and the Steelers drafted Deontay Johnson last year at 5'10" and 183 pounds, where Johnson seems like a much more natural fit from the slot, relying more on his quickness rather than size and athleticism the way that Smith-Schuster might do things. So Smith-Schuster may be more important for the Steelers now than ever, but it just may not translate into the same fantasy production that you were accustomed to when he had Antonio Brown running around out wide and drawing a lot of attention away from him.
Good points. Kubiak has Smith-Schuster 28th, whereas ESPN has him 12th. I know people have seemed to start coming around on Juju after a down year, probably figuring it was due to quarterback play, but I do like the points you make there. Deontay Johnson's stock has also been a rocket ship. So he might be the receiver to own in that offense. Who knows?
And James Washington, really, I think he was probably the most successful of all of them in terms of DVOA last season, although maybe doesn't have the right profile for fantasy success as more of a deep threat.
I liked Washington a lot coming out of college. Hopefully now that he's got a couple of years experience under his belt, he starts to turn into some tangible results. I know he ran a very robust route tree in college, which caught my eye. So
he's a guy that there's definitely, I think, some disagreement in the FO staff about, because Scott and I think are a little high on him, and Rivers McCown, who wrote the Pittsburgh chapter, is not as high on him.
A lot of unknowns in that Pittsburgh offense this year, but another team to look out for. Let's see, what's their win total?
Nine. We have them very high.
9.5 projected wins.
I think the Steelers may have the best defense in football, though. I don't know if that's what their DVOA projection is, but from a fantasy perspective, they're definitely one of the top ones.
From a fantasy perspective, we have them as the top defense. From a DVOA perspective, they're among the top defenses. But, of course, the defensive projections are so close together that they could be the number one defense.
Or they could regress, right?
They had a lot of interceptions last year, so there will be some regression on the interceptions. I think they ended up with more takeaways per drive than even the Patriots by the end of the season.
I'm excited about the Bucs defense. I'm not talking about number one or even a top tier defense, but based on the metrics, it seems like they're due for a bounce back. I think that has a lot to do with
They were already a strong defense last year.
Yeah, right.
The Bucks last year were maybe the biggest difference between like traditional defensive statistics like points allowed and DVOA, because Jameis Winston really put them in terrible situation time after time, throwing interceptions and interceptions on his side of the field, and frankly throwing 7 interceptions returned for touchdowns. Yeah. So if you actually look at their like per play productivity on defense, the Bucks were exceptional, and particularly exceptional in run defense, even though they had the overall sacks leader in the NFL too.
Yeah, perhaps the biggest difference between perception and reality there. And they returned 11 out of 12 starters, and the only new player is Antoine Winfield Jr., who I'm high on. So I remember last year how stingy the Bucks run defense was in fantasy. I would avoid them, which I don't usually do that sort of thing. Okay, moving on to the tight end position. We'll look at a couple of guys here. We'll start off with the Yak is high on. That is Tyler Higbee.
Yeah, I definitely love Higbee. This may be bleeding a little bit from my own perspective, but it's definitely true that Higbee saw his workload increase dramatically over the second half of last season. Just 3.4 targets per game before the team's week 11 bye. And that ballooned up to 10.3 targets per game after, which was the most among NFL tight ends over that 6-game stretch. The team lost Brandon Cooks in the offseason, and Josh Reynolds, the wide receiver, I think is probably the player-specific replacement for him. But Reynolds isn't the same effective player that Cooks has been. Just 16 DYAR and 120 career targets in his career, just a 51% career catch percentage. In my mind, Reynolds is more or less a replacement-level wide receiver. So I think this is probably a situation where Higbee will be the major beneficiary of where those extra targets that Cooks used to take will go. Higbee, meanwhile, was a solid 5.5% DVOA overall last season. To me, he's a player on the rise. Maybe not necessarily in the elite class because of some risk, but I'm comfortable with him as the 5th-rated tight end in fantasy.
Yeah, this is definitely one where there's a workload question where you have to try to guess what the Rams are thinking. Because I've seen other places on the internet where they've been really down on Higbee because so much of his value was in those last 6 games. But I think we're not expecting that his per play efficiency is going to be what it was in those last 6 games. And we're also thinking past just how much has Higbee been used in the past towards the question of what will the Rams be doing in the future? And thinking of Higbee in terms of replacing Brandon Cooks, not just Higbee's last 6 games versus Higbee's career before then.
Exactly.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you guys there. I have a feeling kind of seemed like the Rams discovered something there late in the season with Higbee and started feeding him the ball more. Cooks out of the picture, and the Rams offense not really thrown to the running back position much last year. Seems like Higbee's a comfortable number 3 in that offense, and that's pretty good for a tight end. And then a guy that Kubiak is lower on than the consensus is Rob Gronkowski. Kubiak has him 19th, where ESPN has him 6th.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't say hate, because Gronkowski is unhateable in my mind. But we definitely don't really like his fantasy prospects. Although I guess this is really more a mean projection than it is like a ceiling or floor type of deal, because obviously Gronkowski has major upside. But like the Browns, who we were talking about earlier, the Bucs have just so many talented receiving options that it's going to be difficult for all of them to hit their ADPs. So overall, we project the Bucs for 37.8 pass attempts per game, 3rd most in football. But if you add up the targets per game of Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, O.J. Howard, and their running backs last season, it adds up to 28.7. So, I mean, you've filled them up very quickly. And so you're kind of hitting a point where you're going to have to say that someone is probably going to be a pretty major loser in this offense from a workload perspective. And while you hesitate to say it's Gronk because of the history that he's had with Tom Brady, in Bruce Arians' teams, the tight ends have almost always been the losers. So in his career as both a coach for the Colts, the Cardinals, and now the Buccaneers, which is a total of 8 seasons, he's peaked with his offenses with a 19.6% target share for his tight ends. And that peak rating would only have been 16th in the league last season. So it's a guy that really relies more heavily on the wide receivers than the tight ends. Something that I think probably informs the fact that Howard really had a very disappointing fantasy season last year, while Godwin and Evans were just monsters in fantasy. Meanwhile, Gronk, it's been a while. He hasn't played in a year. Even in his last healthy year, had a career low 13.3% receiving DVOA and 3 touchdowns, career low in a healthy year at least. Howard was actually a better, more effective player last year, 25.3% career DVOA. So I don't think Gronk takes over all of the tight end targets anyway. So it's really a situation where I think there's a lot of red flags here with Gronk. Maybe he has a lot of touchdown upside, but even giving him two more touchdowns than we're giving him jumps him to 13th rather than into the top 10. I think that's probably a better way to think of him in my mind.
For as much talent as there is on the Bucs offense, I feel like there are a lot of unknowns in terms of how Gronk will bounce back from a year off.
It's more fun if we're wrong about Gronk.
Absolutely.
But we're not here just to be fun. We're here to try to be accurate.
it's very much the Nick Chubb thing where, you know, Gronkowski had 47 catches his last year. He had 47 overall on average over his last 3 years. I don't think he's just going to suddenly catch 65 balls again. You know, that would be odd.
When he's sharing the field with Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, everyone is like, Brady finally gets to play with Mike Evans and Chris Godwin. And now you're going to what? Give all of Mike Evans and Chris Godwin's targets to Gronk? I mean, they're Mike Evans and Chris Godwin. That's not going to happen.
It's going to be fun to look back on the season and how that offense produced and compare it to what we all thought it would do. What do you guys think in terms of O.J. Howard's usage? Do you think he'll be on the field a lot, or Tyler Johnson? How do you think those guys will be?
I would expect more O.J. Howard than Tyler Johnson, but I don't think O.J. Howard's going to put up anything that even resembles fantasy appropriate numbers. I like Tyler Johnson. He was awesome in playmaker score. He was like our big late round steal, but I think there'll be a lot of two tight end stuff. O.J. Howard is really talented.
Howard's probably just going to be annoying enough to make Gronk's value not as good as you would want in fantasy.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Much better in real football than in fantasy.
Maybe we'll be surprised about Tyler Johnson. I don't think he is really draftable in redraft formats, but a guy to keep an eye on, who's someone I was very high on in college, and Aaron, you reiterated that a moment ago. He saw a very high percentage of his team's red zone targets, which is something that's been said as an indicator for future success. So in that offense with Brady running out of the slot, crazier things have happened. That'll do it for today's episode. Thanks to all of our listeners. Please review us on iTunes and let us know what you think. It's also your last chance to get involved with the SIS Football Analytics Challenge, where all proceeds are going to the United Negro College Fund. Entries are due on Sunday night, but donations will be accepted for the next few weeks. To find out more information, check out our Twitter page, sportsinfo_SIS. The Football Outsiders Almanac is now available. Very exciting. You can purchase the PDF version of the Football Outsiders Almanac 2020 as part of the Almanac subscription, which gives you access to the entire archive of Football Outsiders Almanacs going back to 2009. The print version will be available on Amazon next week. Be sure to get your copy. For my co-host Aaron Schatz and our guest Scott Spratt, our producer Justin Stein, and Matt Manicharian, who will be back next week, I'm Corey March, and thank you for joining us on our latest episode of Off the Charts Football Podcast.